We're going to learn about Ecclesiastes this quarter. I will be teaching for the first time an adult class. So you have to be gentle on me. But I hope that we can have a good discussion, a good dialogue in class. And you know, I can get a lot of participation and involvement from you, you know, and what you think, and you know, just discuss, you know, and learn together. I think that's best for all of us, for staying awake and for learning. We're all involved, and it might make it a little bit easier on me, maybe. And I hope everyone has the first lesson is the introduction. Everyone has that, I hope. And I also have the second lesson for chapter one. Does anyone need that? We shouldn't get into it tonight, but see. Does anyone find value in receiving it electronically? So I'm told that some people prefer to work theirs on your computer, and I can certainly send it to everyone.
Well, if you send it electronically, if it's something you lose, when we can print another one out.
Yeah, so I'll try to send it to everybody. I think I sent the Ecclesiastes text to nearly everyone. Did anyone not receive that? Well, he sent it to me, so you have to have it.
We got it. Yeah, that's it.
So does anybody else need it electronically?
I'll make him send it to me.
All right. Okay. I thought I sent it to one of your many addresses.
You might have one. Maybe it's at my work.
Okay. Gmail, was that? Or no, your AOL. I sent it to an AOL account because you said not to send stuff to work. Well, I'll send it to y'all and hopefully get it. I wasn't getting anybody addresses. Anyway, so I'll have the next material available beforehand and electronically so you can do what you need to do if you lose something. I hope to make each of these lessons cover two class periods. And if we finish one in one class, you know, I'll start worrying. But if we discuss it and we go through it, I think we'll be all right. And the material can be difficult, and you know, we're talking about something Solomon wrote, a lot of wisdom, a lot of reasoning, logically thinking through it, and careful attention to the definitions of the terms used. So I think I don't think we'll fly through it too quickly. I hope everyone read the book and had some impressions and marked them down. Does anyone want to share what they might have, what they gleaned from the book and the impressions or feelings or whatnot?
It's really depressing if you look at it. It sounds like there's not anything, and yet I think it also gives us some idea of living life under the sun and enjoying it, not always storing up for something that may not happen. It can be depressing or it can be encouraging, depending on which part you pick up.
Enjoy what you have, right? Mm-hmm. Right. So help you look. It can shift your, your focus, your priority in life. Any other thoughts?
Chapter 12, verse 1. It says, remember the creators in the days of your youth, before the evil days come and the years draw near, when you say I have delight in them. I guess this would more so apply to Laura and myself, because we're considerably young, and apply to you. And, you know, everything's vanity, pretty much as he's saying it. So what he's saying is, you know, why kill ourselves and work for all these things that are just going to vanish, when the whole point of our life is to be obedient to God. And so you take that theme throughout the whole book of Ecclesiastes, and that's how I can apply Ecclesiastes to my youthfulness, is to remember him all the days of my youth. And that's one thing I picked up.
And that's shifting some of the focus. Hey, that's the final conclusion. You're right. Yeah. I guess it does. You know, it does help you to focus on what you have now versus, you know, what you don't have later. Hello? Yeah, it does have some good meaning to those who are young and, you know, just their different point of views in life as we go through life. Any other comments? I know myself, it helps. When I read it, you know, I agree. It's a little depressing. You know, you can get a little sad by like the meaning and all. But I think it also helps to kind of shock you out of the normal kind of routine you get into. It knocks you out of that and helps you reevaluate your priorities and reevaluate some of the activities, you know, that you're involved with. You know, it's a different outlook on life. And so those are our initial comments, and after we study the class, we can come back and see, as we learn more, you know, how our thoughts of the book change, if any, if at all. So, the title, Ecclesiastes, that's what's in my Bible, depending on your version. But what does Ecclesiastes mean? Is it a word we've ever heard of or used anywhere else in the English language? It's not that I know of. It's a transliterated Greek word, which means they took a Greek word, instead of translating it, they just used the same word. We have to guess the meaning, like baptism. They transliterated that. We pronounce it Ecclesiastes. And the etymology of the word is as it's traced through its origins, comes from the Latin Ecclesiastes, which derives from the Greek Ecclesiastes. I don't know if those are pronounced differently. They probably are. But I don't know how to pronounce it. And it literally means preacher. And it derives from the Hebrew Koheleth. And in the Greek, Ecclesiastes comes from a member of assembly, which an ecclesia is an assembly. So you pull together and make Ecclesiastes as one of the members of that assembly. And so we see the term preacher. And I don't know what that brings to thought in your mind. It, you know, it varies, but a lot of times just the term preacher itself, you know, doesn't have a whole lot of significant meaning in our culture. But if you look back into the Hebrew from Koheleth, where it's derived from, they had the meaning they had was a person in the act of calling together an assembly for the purpose of addressing that assembly. And I think it had some connotations of, you know, instruction involved. Here you're calling together the assembly to instruct them. The word has changed over time, and what they used it as had probably more connotation than the word preacher has to us. But one point there is, if you look at Ecclesiastes, it's plural. And why do we think it might be plural? Ecclesiastes 12, verse
9. What made you believe it's plural?
Wow, I read it somewhere. Also, it may not necessarily be plural, but I guess what I'm trying to get to is the when I was reading some material that spoke about the word, the Hebrew word Koheleth, it had, you know, their literal definition was, you know, the person and calling people together in assembly. They also made mention that there's a possibility of a deeper meaning or an additional meaning. If you turn to Ecclesiastes 12, verse 9 through 10, we see he goes through the preacher's, well, the author is speaking. And then it changes, I guess, a person. And it says, moreover, because the preacher was wise, he still taught the people knowledge. Yes, he pondered and sought out and set in order many proverbs. The preacher sought to find acceptable words, and what was written was upright words of truth. And so he goes through a first-person dialogue where the preacher is talking as himself, and, you know, I said and says and so forth. And then it goes to the third person. He's referencing himself in the third person, unless this is some kind of addition to the end that someone else made other than the author. But I wanted to draw your attention to Proverbs chapter 1. But I could be wrong with this. Your thoughts are welcome. Proverbs chapter 1, verse 20. We see here, beginning verse 20, wisdom calls aloud outside. She raises her voice in the open squares. She cries out in the chief concourses. At the openings of the gates in the city, she speaks her words. I can stop there. So see, here we see wisdom as a personified being. And of course, that's, you know, the wisdom is... wisdom isn't actually calling out to people, but it's calling out through people. And so there's a possibility that you could see that same sort of connotation from this term, the Koheleth, that the Hebrews use. Yes, it's a person who's leading assembly that's trying to instruct them, but it's also in a form of, or a possibility is in the form of, you know, wisdom reaching out to instruct others. You can disagree with that. It's not of extreme importance. You don't have any comments on that?
Who titled this book?
Who titled the book? Ecclesiastes?
The little notes in my book, I don't know. It says that English titles are taken from the Septuagint word preacher.
Yeah, from Ecclesiastes itself, the transliterated word. Yeah, that's I don't know what you call those. The translators.
I'd be curious if you quote. It's not like this, it's not an important thing, but it's kind of like the word molasses. Molasses is not pearl. Campbell's is not pearl. Diabetes, yes, not pearl. And I don't think it's a plural word, but you know, I'd be curious if it is where you got the data on that.
Yeah.
Just I think it means a pearl.
Yeah, you may be correct. But I also saw that bit about the wisdom personified, and I thought it was interesting, and I sort of tied that in with that. Anyway, we can move on. And like I said, we got the title of the book from our translators, Ecclesiastes, which was the transliterated word for preacher. Oh, yeah. It's a translated word from Hebrew to Greek, and of course it's our transliterated word. But there's also other titles, some called the preacher. It's also translated the teacher or leader of the assembly. And I think all of these apply, you know. So who was the author? You know, if we read through, the author isn't identified by name, but there's statements made about the author, and from that we can imply and defer, understand possibly who wrote it, and with some good amount of fact. And of course, the traditional view, I think I've already stated it, was that Solomon wrote this. And how do we determine that? In the very first verse, we see the words of the preacher, the son of David, king of Jerusalem. So he's the king, and he was the son of David. And also in verse 12, we see the same thing. I, the preacher, was king over Israel and Jerusalem. That applies to a lot of people, but we move on to the same chapter, verse 16. So that I communed with my heart, saying, look, I have attained greatness and have gained more wisdom than all who were before me in Jerusalem. My heart has understood great wisdom and knowledge. And if you turn over to First Kings, chapter 3. First Kings 3, beginning in verse 7. We're reading about Solomon, the Chronicles of Solomon. And this is where God comes to Solomon in a dream. He says, now, Lord my God, you have made your servant king instead of my father David. But I am a little child and do not know how to go out or come in. And your servant is in the midst of your people, whom you have chosen, a great people, too numerous to be numbered or counted. Therefore give to your servant an understanding heart to judge your people, that I may discern between good and evil. For who is able to judge this great people of yours? And this speech pleased the Lord, that Solomon asked this. He said, because you have asked this thing and have not asked long life for yourself, nor riches, nor life of your enemies, but have asked for understanding to discern justice. Verse 12, behold, I have done according to your words. See, I have given you a wise and understanding heart, so that there has not been anyone like you before you, nor shall any like you arise after you. And also in chapter 4, verse 29. So then God gave Solomon wisdom and exceedingly great understanding, and largeness of heart like the sand in the seashore. And thus Solomon's wisdom excelled the wisdom of all the men of the east and all the wisdom of Egypt, for he was wiser than all men, than Ethan the Ezraite, than Hanan, than Chalcol or Darda, the sons of Mahal. His fame was in all the surrounding nations. And so we see here, by God's own word, Solomon was wiser than all before him and wiser than all who would ever come after him. He was the wisest man on earth. And if that fits, you know, precisely into what the statement that the preacher made. He's claiming to be the wisest before him. So this person came after Solomon. He's lying, because Solomon was the wisest, unless he came before him. So don't think that's the case. Of course, Solomon came right after David, and this guy's saying he's the son of David. So it'd have to be Solomon or someone afterwards. Anyway, so see, this person had great wisdom, which fits in with Solomon. And also in Ecclesiastes 2, 7 through 9, we see the wealth of the preacher. He says, I acquired male and female servants, and had servants born in my house. Yes, I had greater possessions of herds and flocks than all who were in Jerusalem before me. I also gathered for myself silver and gold and special treasures of kings and of the provinces. I acquired male and female singers, the delights of the sons of men, and musical instruments of all kinds. So I became great and excelled more than all who were before me in Jerusalem. Also my wisdom remained with me. So he had all these things in 1 Kings 3. I hope you held your finger there. Mm-hmm. Going back to Solomon's account. 12 through 15. We just read this, that God gave Solomon his desire, his request to have knowledge. And God follows up and says, Behold, I have done according to your words. I've given you understanding and wisdom. And in verse 13 it says, I have also given you what you have not asked, both riches and honor, so that there shall not be anyone like you among the kings all your days. And you turn over to chapter 4, 21 through 29. And I'm not going to read all that, but it basically goes into an account of all the riches Solomon had. So maybe I'll read this once. We'll actually come back to it again in another lesson, but we'll skip it then. So beginning verse 21, Solomon reigned over all kingdoms from the river to the land of the Philistines. As far as the borders of Egypt, they brought tributes and served Solomon all the days of his life. Now Solomon's provision was for one day it was 30 cores of fine flour, 60 cores of meal, 10 fatted oxen, 20 oxen from the pastures, and 100 sheep, besides deer, gazelles, roebucks, and fatted owl. And that was all per day. For he had dominion over all the side of the river from Tiphsah even to Gaza, namely over all the kings on the side of the river. He had peace on every side. And Judah and Israel dwelt safely. Let's get that, move on. 26, he had 40,000 stalls of horses for his chariots, 12,000 horsemen. He had barley, straw in the proper place. He had a lot of stuff. He had great riches. And I think, verse 29. Okay, just a first. So he had great wealth. So here we see a correlation between the preachers claiming to have the great wealth and Solomon's great wealth. And you also see the same in 2 Chronicles 9, 13 through 28. I think, I'm starting to forget things now. Pretty much, I think it's the same thing, but I'm going to glance at it real quick. I think there is one point in 2 Chronicles 9. I'm not going to read all the scriptures I pointed to. They just list all his wealth. But in verse 27, I'd like to point out, it says, The king made silver as common in Jerusalem as stones, and he made cedar trees as abundant as the sycamores which are in the lowlands. And so this clearly points to how great he was and how his greatness and his wealth profited the entire region, that silver was common in Jerusalem as stones. it was no great matter anymore, and sycamores, which came from a land further to the north, something that's, takes a great deal of wealth to transport and deliver, as, things that are rare, highly valued, he had these in abundance. So he did have great wealth. So see, it's that correlation between the preacher and Solomon. It also establishes him as the author. And any other comments on that? Pretty straightforward stuff here.
He was,
we'll get to the hard stuff later.
Honestly, he was so wealthy in verse 21, you see that he sent ships to Tarshish with the servants of Huram, and every 3 years the ships of Tarshish came back bringing him gold and silver, ivory, and apes and peacocks. So, I mean, not only did he amass wealth, but people were bringing wealth to him because he was so well known, and his kingdom was the biggest that it would ever be.
Yeah. You also see that in other scriptures where his wisdom drew the attention of the surrounding, everyone in the surrounding area. They came to him and gave him more things just to hear of his wisdom. And so, of course, he benefited from that as well. He used his wisdom to gain mass riches in his own country, and people continued to bring more to him. Ecclesiastes chapter 2. We can look to some of the acts that the preacher did that correlate with what Solomon did. We see in beginning in verse 4 in chapter 2 of Ecclesiastes. It says, the preacher's claims, I made my works great. I built myself houses and planted myself vineyards. I made myself gardens and orchards. I planted all kinds of fruit trees in them. I made myself water pools from which to water the growing trees of the grove. And so here's just some of the acts he did. He made great works. And over in 1 Kings chapter 7, chapter 7 of 1 Kings, beginning verse 1. But Solomon took 13 years to build his own house. So he finished his house, and he also built the house of the forest of Lebanon. Its length was 100 cubits. There's rows of cedar and pillars. And it was paneled with cedar above the beams. There were on 45 pillars, 15 to a row. There were windows with beveled frames in three rows, and window was opposite window in three tiers. All the doorways and doorposts had rectangular frames, and window was opposite window in three tiers. He also made the hall of pillars, and its length was 50 cubits, and its width was 30 cubits. And in front of them was a portico with pillars, and a canopy was in front of them. Then he made a hall for the throne, the hall of judgment, where he might judge, and it was paneled with cedar from floor to ceiling. And in, let's see, in verse 8, he also made a house like this hall for Pharaoh's daughter, whom he had taken as wife. And all these were of costly, stones cut to size, trimmed with saws, inside and out from the foundation to the eaves, and also on the outside to the great court. The foundation was of costly stones, large stones, some 10 cubits and some 8 cubits. And above were costly stones, hewn to size and cedar wood. The great court was enclosed with three rows of hewn stone and a row of cedar beam. And so we see, it's a lot of detail in there, but we see how great his buildings were. We see how large they were. We see how just grand they were. They were lavish with expensive items, those of a great, great wealthy king. And we turn also to Ecclesiastes 7. Verse 26, we see the preacher had difficulties in ensnarement by women. Beginning verse 26, I find more bitter than death the woman whose heart is snares and nets, whose hands are fetters. He who pleases God shall escape from her, but the sinner shall be trapped by her. Here's what I have found, says the preacher, adding one thing to the other to find out the reason, which my soul still seeks, but I cannot find. One man among a thousand I have found, but a woman among all these I have not found. And I don't know if that exactly makes him special, but that probably happens to a lot of people, especially of wealth and greatness. But in 1 Kings chapter 11, we know the same occurred to Solomon. Solomon. 1 Kings 11, chapter 1. But King Solomon loved many foreign women, as well as the daughters of Pharaoh, women of the Moabites, Ammonites, Edomites, Sidonites, and Hittites, from the nations of whom the Lord had said to the children of Israel, "You shall not intermarry with them, nor they with you. Surely they will turn away your hearts after the gods, their gods." Solomon clung to these in love. And he had 700 wives, princesses, and 300 concubines. And his wives turned away his heart. For it was so when Solomon was old that his wives turned his heart after other gods, and his heart was not loyal to the Lord his God as was the heart of his father David. For Solomon went after Ashtoreth, the goddess of the Sidonians, and after Milcom, the abomination of the Ammonites. Solomon did evil in the sight of the Lord and did not fully follow the Lord as he did his father David. And then he built a high place for Chemosh, the abomination of Moab, on the hill that is east of Jerusalem, and for Molech, the abomination of the people of Ammon. And he did likewise for all his foreign wives who burned incense and sacrificed to their gods. So the Lord... Okay, that's the stuff there. So we see that his wives, whom he cherished, led him astray. And it's believed that perhaps he came back from that, as we see later through Ecclesiastes. And so we have this correlation between the two. Just another point, in fact.
Michael?
Yes?
Solomon made the same mistake, though, that a lot of men do today. They seek wives in the wrong place. Of course, he wasn't supposed to have them in the first place. That was his first mistake. But he looked in the wrong places. God told him to choose a wife from among his people. And he didn't do that. It was the foreign wives that turned his heart away from God. And
yeah.
So, no wonder he couldn't find a good one. He wasn't looking for a good one.
Yeah. He had one. For all his wisdom, he did make mistakes. He was still a man, and God told him what to do, and he didn't follow it in this circumstance. Maybe wisdom got to his head. He thought he could handle it. All speculation. I don't know. But he didn't follow what God told him to do. You know, that's the beginning of wisdom, obedience to God. And Ecclesiastes 12, 9-10. We'll see a few other correlations. The activities of the preacher. In 9-10 in chapter 12. And moreover, because the preacher was wise, he still taught the people knowledge, and yes, he pondered and sought out and set in order many proverbs. The preacher sought to find acceptable words, and what was written was upright, words of truth. So you see here, he had written many proverbs. And we know Solomon is well known for that. 1 Kings chapter 4, verse 30. We already read verse 30 and 31, speaking of his wisdom. The beginning of verse 32, it said, "He spoke 3,000 proverbs, and his songs were 1,005. He also spoke of the trees from the cedar of Lebanon, even to the hyssop that spring out of the wall. He spoke of also of animals, of birds, of creeping things, and of fish. And the men of all the nations from all the kings of the earth who had heard of his wisdom came to hear the wisdom of Solomon." So he had wisdom in all many things. And here the correlation, of course, is the proverbs that Solomon wrote. And the preacher also claims to have written many, many proverbs. We also see in Proverbs chapter 1, of course, you know, that Solomon claims to have written all of these proverbs, which just goes in that same fact. So, with all these, I guess, simultaneous events, I think it pretty strongly suggests that Solomon is the author. And that's what most Jews and most Christians believe today. There have been arguments against an authorship of Solomon. I think there's strong cases for Solomon, but we're going to look at these just so you're aware of them. In Ecclesiastes 3:16. messed it up yet. This is in 16. Moreover, I saw under the sun, in the place of judgment, wickedness was there, and in the place of righteousness, iniquity was there. And we also see over in 4, verse 13, better a poor and wise youth than an old and foolish king, who will be admonished no more. For as he comes out of the prison to be king, although he was born poor in his kingdom, I saw all the living who walk under the sun, they were with the second youth who stands in this place. There was no end of all the people over whom he was made king, yet those who come after him will not rejoice in him. Surely this is vanity and grasping for the wind. And in 5, verse 8, he also speaks of, if you see the oppression of the poor and the violent, perversion of justice and righteousness in a province, do not marvel at the matter, for high official watches over a high official, and higher officials watch over them. So, these antagonists would claim, if he's, you know, the ruler in his kingdom, he's viewing these, I guess the assumption is, there he's viewing these things within his own kingdom. And he's supposed to have a great kingdom, he's supposed to be full of peace. One, why would he speak so of his own kingdom, of where he's ruler? It's bringing out your own faults, so to say. Most men wouldn't do such a thing. How would you argue against that? I already have the answer.
I think the whole Ecclesiastics is about having good and bad. So, I mean, his kingdom, even though they would say, you know, for good, I mean, there wasn't bad either.
Yeah. Well, I think I know what you're saying. It's in Ecclesiastes, he's reading from a philosophical standpoint, an objective standpoint to find wisdom. I mean, to find the answer through wisdom. We know that, you know, in college, at least I had it in college, and a lot of times people say in order to make a wise decision, you have to remove your subjectivity from it, you know, not let emotions play their part, to truly be objective and to view the data without bias. And so that's one possibility. As a philosopher, he can read into what's the faults in his own kingdom and speak objectively about them. I don't think you'll find anywhere that said Solomon's kingdom was perfect. You know, the only kingdom we're going to have no poor and perfection is the kingdom in heaven. And certainly, Solomon was rich, he was wealthy, and his kingdom had the greatest prosperity. You know, Israel had the greatest prosperity during this time. But it doesn't mean every single person was rich. That they didn't have some, there wasn't, some people weren't still afflicted with poverty. It doesn't mean that if he was a wise ruler, it doesn't mean he could rule the entire nation single-handedly. He has to rely on other men. It doesn't mean that those other men might not be corrupt. Rocky, do you have a question?
Yeah, I think from all the arguments here, you're assuming that he's writing about his kingdom. But he's writing about all different points of life. And there are other verses that just, you know, go against it. You know, the first one, he's an old and foolish king. Well, you just said he's one of the wisest men. So he's not necessarily writing about his own kingdom. He's talking about life under the sun and different avenues, and could be expanding, you know, not just his kingdom, but looking at other kingdoms and the way things are under the sun, not just focusing on his own.
That's correct. And we read 1 Kings in chapter 4, he talked about all the kingdoms he ruled over that gave him, were subject to him. Those are other kingdoms. I mean, a great king, he had more view than what was just in his kingdom. I spoke about foreigners coming to him. You know, he had access and knowledge outside of his own kingdom. There's nothing, you're exactly right, there's nothing in these scriptures that says he's talking about his kingdom. He's just talking about the knowledge, a fact of, even maybe a fact of before he was king himself. Craig, did you raise your hand?
Yes. Well, he uses dialogue also, and when he uses dialogue, sometimes he talks about, I have seen, or I. Now, even talking about the lives. He said, I've discovered this, I'm seeking but have not found. He's talking about himself, but here he's just kind of, it's like what Rocky said, he's not necessarily talking about his own.
Hey, he's just discussing facts in the world, right?
It could have been at the end of his, if this was written at the end of his reign, that after the foreign women had taken him away from God, they did have trouble. God did send people against them, and there was wickedness in his nation at the end of his reign. So there wasn't peace at the end of his reign. We can read about that, and so this could very well be at the end. He may be seeing himself as, you know, I've become this old foolish king. I should be like the young lad who had the people's interest at heart, not my own. Yeah,
that's correct. But I think all of those points, you know, these the points made against it, none of them, I think, significantly impact him as the author. Any other comments on that?
I agree. In your study, at least one thing you say is not supplement. Did anybody that you read say who they thought it was? Is there an alternative?
No, I never saw anything that suggested who they thought it was, just that they kind of didn't think it was Solomon. Yeah. And we're going to go through each of these things, and by the end, I thought they were all very weak, and they get feebler as we go through. So move on. They also, they claim the language, the linguistics, the language he used was of Chaldean influence, which they would suggest, that they're suggesting came from a period when they were conquered by, they went into exile under the Chaldeans and the Babylonians, that influence then was, they were then subjected to that influence, therefore that dates the book at a time post-exile. So, you know, hundreds of years later, after Solomon reigned. I can't speak knowledgeably to this, but, I've read there's the fact that there's experts that go both ways. There's just not enough data. This book falls in a period when there's not too much else written, and there's not a whole lot of comparison. So some experts say, no, no, it came from post-exile. Other ones are like, no, no, it fits right where it is. I think when we read about the extent of his kingdom, it's very possible, you know, we don't know how much influence the other nations had on him. As he's writing, you know, he could have brought some of that dialogue in. And so it's just there's not a whole lot to go on right there. I'm not a linguistics expert, and so I left out most of those, the, you know, specific ideas out. I have another point. But another point I was reading is, it's just in passing, we do read about God in the Ecclesiastes. It mentions God several times. It might not have any bearing, but the one thing, they're saying the Hebrew used Jehovah for the word for God, and through this book it was stated that Jehovah was never used. They used a different word that was just sort of in representation of just a God. Like if someone else was talking about, oh, those, you know, Egyptian gods, they would use Elohim, which means it's not the same word they use for the Jewish God, the true God. So that word is a word that I read was used throughout Ecclesiastes. From that standpoint, it was suggested that this book, based on wisdom, you know, was of course written by Hebrew for the Hebrew people, but it could also be used for all the other peoples of the earth. You know, you don't have to come into this book with strong belief in God to, you know, read through the reasoning and understand his conclusions he makes. So, with the extent of his kingdom, with the power, and I guess that's what I'm looking for. His influence on his people and other peoples. He might have written it for a broader audience than just Hebrews. Just something in passing. We know Proverbs and Song of Solomon were written by Solomon. And it's been pointed out the dissimilarities of the style between those two books and this book. And they say that points to the fact that it could be a different author. However, which of us writes the exact same way throughout our entire lives versus when you're first learning in school to wherever you are now, and just out of college or further on? So that, I don't think, has much bearing. We know that this could have been written in his old age, and so from the time of his youth when he wrote Proverbs, if he wrote Proverbs in his youth, just the time difference, or, you know, in the experience he's had in his life changed his views. We know he was influenced by foreign women, and if he came back, that could have been some bitter experience for him and changed his outlook on things. We know the other books were praise to God, and this book is philosophical reasoning. And so I know when I write a personal paper and then I go to work and write some kind of engineering technical document, I have a big difference in how I write and the words I use. At work, I'm going for professionalism, and clarity, and well, not that I'm not going for clarity anywhere else, but I use different words. And so the context of the subject matter can also dictate the words he uses and account for that dissimilarity of style.
He's also supposed to be so full of wisdom, he could have written it however he wanted.
It's true. He can change however he knew. I mean, of great knowledge and of great wisdom, he would have the ability to know different styles of writing and choose that which best fits maybe like the broader audience we're talking about or the subject matter. And also, one other thing, in John, we know John wrote the Gospel of John and also Revelations. And people have noted the dissimilarity there, yet still both are accredited to John. It shows proof in the Gospel, in the Scriptures themselves, one author can write differently at different times.
Well, I don't think that Proverbs and Song of Solomon are particularly similar styles of writing.
I find some stuff in Ecclesiastes similar to Proverbs.
Yeah, chapter 7.
Yeah, chapter 7 is a lot.
So, whoever wrote who's challenging this, I thought, pretty weak. It's weak. There's not a lot backing this up. I mean, in view of the other evidences we read, the similarities between the preacher and Solomon, that's strong factual information. And of a person of Solomon, with those kind of characteristics that distinguished him far above everyone else, for someone else after him to come out and claim the same, that's pretty bold. I think he would have been, if it wasn't Solomon, they were stretching themselves and they would have been shot down pretty quick to make some of the same statements that I'm the wisest that's ever been right after, or at some point in time after Solomon. And, it would have been pointed out a lot earlier. And moving on to some particular phrases that were, I guess, irregular in their wording and that these people questioned. First one is in Ecclesiastes 1:1. It says, "The words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem." And I would have totally flown over this and not even caught it. So, yeah, Solomon was king of Jerusalem. We know he was. But they're pointing to it, oh, he's king of Jerusalem. The argument is that he must have made the statement must have been made when there was more than one seat of power, such as the division between Judah and Israel, where now Jerusalem is the seat of power for Judah, and the seat of power for Israel is somewhere else, and I don't remember at the moment. But so they're, this author pointed out the difference. Here is Jerusalem versus this other place. That doesn't, his statement is indeed fact. It doesn't change the fact that Solomon reigned, and there was only one seat of time, it was in Jerusalem. So, I don't see how you can make that statement. I mean, challenge it with that. And then also in verse 12, it says, "I, the preacher, was king over Israel in Jerusalem." So you see here, we see he was king over Israel, all of Israel, in Jerusalem. But the term was throwing people off, or throw some people off. He was king, as if, in fact, he is no longer king at the time he wrote this. There was a change in power. He isn't in charge anymore. And so Solomon, of course, reigned until his death. So it can't be Solomon. Again, this is a matter of interpretation, the term was, how it's used. I mean, it doesn't imply that just because he said the term was doesn't mean he isn't still, in fact, king of Jerusalem. It may be the fact that this is the point when he mentioned here in verse 13, he says, "I set my heart to seek and search out by wisdom." At that point, I was the king in Jerusalem, and when I started to make this search, it doesn't mean that anything's changed at all. It's just that was a point in time in the past when he began this. He was king of Jerusalem then. And he still is. We can make similar statements today. Someone mentioned something in the past, and I was currently working at HP then, blah, blah, blah. And it doesn't mean you're not, I'm not still there. It's just point in fact, something mentioned. Does anyone have any observations on that? Anything to add? Makes sense, right? Yes? Hey, you said you'd wait till someone would answer, and you're sitting there not answering. Yes, it makes sense. Continue on in verse 16. Oh, we're done. For now. See, that's okay. We're on track. Two classes for this lesson. And did anyone not receive the next lesson? I have here chapter 1. Come in later.